Hey friends, we have a new sponsor today, and I want to make sure that you support them because they make Hansel Minutes possible. RavenDB, it's a document database that's non-relational and fully transactional. It's available for Windows and Linux with official client APIs for .NET, the JVM, Go, Ruby, Node.js, and Python. RavenDB is designed for high performance, handling tens of thousands of requests even on a single node. Now, RavenDB is capable of on-the-fly optimization, dynamic indexes, and much more. It has a fully loaded GUI, which means it's simpler to operate, and you don't need, you know, arcane incantations on the command line. It just works. It's fast, and it's right. Download your free community edition at ravendb.net. That's RavenDB.net. I hope you check it out. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Mark Rendell. We're going to talk about the rise of global developer tools. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. Thank you for asking.
You know, I'm sitting here looking at a Dropbox folder that I made many, many, many years ago, and it's called Utils. And it used to be /utils, and now it's /Dropbox utils. And it's just full of a bunch of crap that I've been carrying around with me for many, many years. I put it in my path, and it's all of my developer utilities, and I thought I was quite clever.
Yeah. I'm really old, so I remember back in the day working on Unix systems, and you would have a bin folder in your user directory, in your home directory, and you would add that to your path, and then anything that you found yourself doing a lot, you just write a quick corn shell script back in those days to repeat that for you.
So it sounds like I've got history to back me up that this was a good idea for a period of time as a developer.
Absolutely. It was very kind of clunky sticks and sellotape and string way of building your own toolkit and carrying it around with you.
Well, now I've got Ubuntu on Windows 10 and I just do like apt-get install. Or if I'm running, you know, other operating systems, I might say Yum. Or on Windows, I could also use the Chocolaty tool. But these aren't really for developer tools per se, right? Why are we separating developer tools from operating system installation stuff?
So writing something to go on apt-get or Yum or Homebrew or any of those things, or submitting something to Chocolaty is quite complicated, and you've got to distribute something that is executable and something that's executable on everybody's system. So most of those things are written in C or C++ or Rust or maybe Go these days. You can assume when developers are looking to use your tools, if I'm writing a tool for Node, then it seems fairly safe to assume that the developers that are going to be using that have got Node installed. So you can just target Node and deploy an NPM package, and then they can use that. You don't have to worry about runtimes and executability and all that sort of stuff.
Okay, so are you saying that a Node developer, in the course of their natural development of whatever they happen to be writing, might want something that will support their development process? And since we already know that they're using Node, and really that they can't use anything else because they're going to be using the Node package installation process, we'll just support them by allowing them to arbitrarily bring in other kind of like sidecar tools that can sit alongside their development process.
Yeah. I mean, TypeScript has grown way beyond Microsoft and way beyond being a Visual Studio plugin. So the primary way that TypeScript is distributed is as an NPM package. And you do npm install -g TypeScript, and it puts the TypeScript compiler onto your system and adds a TSC command line tool that you can then use in any directory and compile your TypeScript. And there's, you know, that's just one example. There are hundreds of these things, Webpack and SAS and Uglify, all sorts of things distributed all through npm.js.
And that's amazing, though, that using Node as an example, that NPM has become such a, I mean, it's its own, like you said, apt or apt get of its own. And we're looking at numbers that are unconscionable. TypeScript is getting, 3 million weekly downloads, 12 million a month.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It is nuts. And the really nice thing with that is the people who are writing software using Node and who think, I need a utility to do something, they can write that utility using the language that they know. They don't have to learn something else. They don't have to go off and learn C++ or Rust, because learning Rust takes a long time. Trust me, I'm learning it. They can just use the tools that they already know, and they can build something helpful, and then it's really easy to create a package and upload it to NPM, and they can share it around, and other people can contribute back to it.
Is this a potential place for us to install viruses, or to have mean people put mean stuff in, and I accidentally install something bad, and then since it's in my path, it's easy to run?
It totally is a very good way to do that, which is makes it a good thing that I think pretty much everything that's on NPM.js is open source, and you can go and have a quick look at the source. And I don't know if they've got any kind of built-in security review or anything like that. It seems like the kind of thing that would hit all the tech news sites if somebody discovered that Leftpad was mining cryptocurrency on your machine every time you ran it.
But it does allow you to break stuff really quickly, like using Leftpad as an example.
Yes, you can take things off the NPM repository, although I think they have done something to ameliorate that now. But as far as global tools are concerned, once you've got that installed on your machine, it's there. It's not going back to NPM. The reason that Leftpad broke the world was because people's continuous integration processes do an NPM install to pull down all the packages that are being used. And when Leftpad went away, the NPM install failed and everybody's build started failing.
Mm. And that's a problem, though. It's a human problem, and it's always going to be something that they're going to work on. Like, you can go up to NPM's blog and read about their concerns around malware, and they're looking for packages with names that are close to existing packages so that someone might install something evil by default on accident, like off by one character. They can do static analysis on the tools. But ultimately, humans are going to do the best they can to make sure that registries stay secure and evil tools don't show up on our machines.
Yeah. And it has to be a human thing. It has to be people being careful and policing things and calling it out if they notice something is doing something dodgy.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said that you're learning Rust, but you and I know each other from the .NET community.
Absolutely.
And for the longest time, we were all excited about and trying to advocate for .NET global tools, so we'd have the .NET equivalent of npm-g, and it's finally happening.
It has. It's with .NET Core 2.1. It's become a real thing. So if you've got .NET Core SDK 2.1.300, although you should have 2.1.400 because that's the current version, and that's the LTS release. But yes, you now have a .NET tool subcommand, and you can say .NET tool install --global, and then give it a NuGet package name, and it'll go off and get that NuGet package and then add it to your path with the name that the package publisher chose for it.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I go to the command line right now and I type .NET space mark, it will say, can't run .NET hyphen mark, as if .NET hyphen mark .exe was a thing.
Yeah. So that's the first way that it tries to find something when you say .NET and a command. You can add subcommands onto .NET by putting .NET dash whatever you want it to be. And it has a set of directories that it'll automatically scan to see if it can find that. And it'll go and look through CSproj files and find the thing that's being invoked, and then see if it can find it in your library cache and so on. But .NET global tools goes a bit beyond that.
Okay, so it's not as simple as put an executable called, you know, .NET-Scott in the path. It's more sophisticated now.
It is more sophisticated. So when you publish your NuGet package with your global tool in it, you add a few extra parameters and you decide what it wants to be invoked as, and you set a thing to say this is a parameter, and then the .NET tool installer, which goes off to NuGet, does a few extra things when it pulls that package down.
Okay. Do we need to think about versioning? Is there a .NET tool update yet, or is this just the beginning?
There is a .NET tool update, which updates to the latest stable version. And by stable version, I mean it doesn't have dash preview or dash beta or anything on the end of it.
Okay, so .NET tool update. So I have lifecycle, I have .NET tool list, install, uninstall, and update. And I'm treating them like they're NuGet packages because they are, in fact, NuGet packages.
Yes, the name that you give the tool is the name of the package on the NuGet repository.
It sounds like there would probably be a bit of a gold rush to try to get people to jump in and get the short commands. Like if I want .NET tool mark, I might want to grab that before some other mark does.
Yes, it seems to be sort of picking up slowly, and there's not a huge number of tools up there just yet. But I can see people wanting to get in there with something if they've got a funky short name.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, while we're at it, in your sort of other job as a PM, whatever you are on the ASP.NET team, mm-hmm. could you get them to shorten the name of .NET ASP.NET dash code generator? Because I type that a lot, and it's a very long word.
Well, that's an interesting point. So .NET hyphen ASP.NET hyphen code generator is really long, and that is the NuGet package name, right? It is also coincidentally the short name, which is ironic because it's not short at all. And that's something that I think we as a community are still trying to figure out. Like another example would be the Cake build system, which would be cake.tool.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they made their short name .NET hyphen cake when it should just be regular, just cake.
Yeah, I don't think there was anything already called cake on most people's systems, because obviously that's, you know, you're not just competing against everybody else on the .NET global tools. You're competing against everything that's already available over APT and anything else that can install command line commands onto your system.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Like if you go and pick a word like hash or script or depends, you could potentially squash other people that care about that, and that can be an issue.
Yeah. And you have to be aware of what's available on different systems as well. So Linux boxes tend to come out of the box with a base64 command. So if you tried to publish a .NET Core global tool for doing base64 things, you would probably clash with that. And then it just comes down to which comes first in the path as to which one's getting invoked.
Mm.
So you need to be quite careful when you pick these names.
Okay, so but that does sound like it's a little bit of a Wild West right now, but at the same time, we don't want a lot of regulation at this point because it will slow people down.
Yeah, you want to have people get out there. And I actually had someone ask me the other day if I could pass over a NuGet package name to them because they've got a new package that does something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really nice name. It's Flux, which I nicked. Whoa, way back, back in the Owen days.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he wants to publish something called Flux. And I need to get back to him and say, yes, of course you can have that. Because
that's nice.
It's just an experimental thing.
Right. So you work as a community, you have these conversations.
Yeah, that's it. People can get in touch with you through NuGet as a way of saying contact owner. And he clicked that button and sent me a very nice, polite message. And I have very rudely not replied to it yet, but I will.
Hey, folks, Intel is a sponsor this week, and I welcome them because they're bringing some high-performance developer tools for all of us. Check out Intel's Parallel Studio XE. I've talked about parallelism before on the show and the importance of using the complete instruction set, unlocking the power of the processor that your code is running on. Now, you all might be writing C or C++, Python, or even Fortran, but is your code building in such a way and written in such a way that it uses the latest techniques for vectorization, multi-threading, multi-node parallelization, or memory optimization? Intel Parallel Studio XE has a lot of new stuff for 2018 across all these languages. Get a free download at bit.ly/ParallelStudioXE, or certainly go and Google or Google with Bing for Intel Parallel Studio XE, and get started boosting your app's performance with smart parallel code with a lot less effort. Check them out, bit.ly/ParallelStudioXE. So we have this in .NET Global Tools. We had this in Node, but it was something that happened in the development community even before this. Would you say it was Gems and Ruby that started this Global Tools concept?
I would. I think I might be risking the wrath of the Python crowd because Python had easy install and pip.
Yeah.
But I think the first thing that I saw myself that did this was Ruby Gems. And you would say gem install global Rails, for example. Mm-hmm. And then that actually added, I think it was just R, or you aliased it or something. But yeah, you would just say Rails generate or RG, and then generate a controller or a view or a active record model or whatever. People were typing very, very long commands with complete model declarations in them. But yes, and SAS is another example. That was originally written in Ruby and distributed as a gem, and that was a global tool. So,
why would I want a global tool and not a project-level tool? Why wouldn't I want all my projects to have their own separate tools and then have everything scoped that way so I don't worry about breaking global paths and everything would just be held with the project, and I would give you the project and you would get the tools that my project cared about?
So that's still available. That's still an option. And it's a perfectly decent option. There are things. So for example, the first global tool that I created and published is called Unpackage, UNPKG. And I started out before it was a global tool, it was a project level tool. And you actually have to open up the csproj file and add a .NET CLI tool reference rather than a package reference. And there's no simple command line way. There's no simple Visual Studio or Rider way of adding a .NET CLI tool reference to a project. You have to go in and edit it. So that makes things slightly difficult. And then you've got that that only works in that one project, and you have to type .NET space and then unpackage and then the rest of the things. So as soon as global tools actually became, so I think it was literally the day after they went RTM with .NET Core 2.1, I published an updated version of the package, which put it in as a global tool, which means whatever project I'm in, I don't have to install anything. I can just say unpackage, add jQuery, and it does everything for me. So it's just a lot more convenient than having to do the same thing over and over again.
What if you gave me your project, though, and maybe it had some associated scripts with it, and then I don't have those tools? What's the best way for me to get up to speed as quickly as possible?
Probably something in the readme saying run this .NET install.
Okay. So there isn't a I typed .NET build and this project depends on these five tools, go and get them.
I would say it would be a bad idea to put things into your build scripts, into your targets files or your csproj files or anything that rely on .NET global tools to run. So again, talking about unpackage, when it was a local tool, build step to do the restore was just execute this shell command, and it was .NET unpackage restore. Once I changed it to being a global tool, I didn't want people to have that global tool installed, but I still wanted the restore on build functionality. And so I created another NuGet package called rendlelabs.unpackage.build, which is a build time package that does the restore, published that, and then added a command line option to unpackage to say add build time restore. So if you clone my repository and it's got an unpackage.json file in it, and then you hit build, it will do the restore because it's using a package reference rather than a .NET CLI tool reference to handle that.
I see. Would you call that a best practice? Is that something that other people should emulate? Or would you just call that something you've figured out and are not quite sure if it's a best practice yet?
I suspect it's a best practice.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly any more tools that I create that require some kind of build time process, I will be doing the same thing.
Mm.
And I will be doing it now by copying and pasting from my unpackage.build script. The first time I did it, I copied and pasted from something Mads Christensen wrote because writing build packages is really complicated and not well documented. So I had fun with that.
Mm. It does sound like a best practice, though, because I think we all agree that someone needs to be able to go and clone a repository and type .NET build and have it be successful without a lot of initial setup and ceremony.
Yeah. And we saw this happen with Node and NPM as well.
Mm-hmm.
So TypeScript, when TypeScript 1.0 came out, you would install it globally, and it would have to be installed globally for the builds to run. So you had to put in things saying you have to install TypeScript before you can build this project. And because there are a lot of these build time things, so you likely got TypeScript and SAS and Webpack and Uglify and all these other things going on. And so now NPM provides, similar to the old style of .NET tool, you can install TypeScript as a dependency within the project so it gets restored. Mm-hmm. And then you can say NPM TS, or there's an NPX TSC now, I think, which lets you run commands that are installed in the project locally. So it's a kind of weird reverse thing. .NET Core 2.1 added a feature that Node had had for ages, and Node quite recently added a feature that .NET had out of the box, .NET Core had anyway.
Do you think that this is something that's going to fundamentally change .NET for the better? Do you think that this is like the beginning of something big, or is this just a small feature that we're enjoying right now?
I really hope it's going to make a difference and encourage people to build more command line tools. I'm working on a set of video training courses at the moment for .NET Core 2.1 and microservices and all sorts of other stuff. And that is going to start with a thing saying, I've written some tools that will make this easier for you to follow along with. So why don't you go and install those? And it's going to be a very command line and Visual Studio Code focused way of building .NET Core applications. So I want to make it as easy as possible to do things from the command line. And there's quite a lot of repetitive stuff. So for example, I want to do something that makes it easy to upgrade a .NET Core 2.1 templated project to use Bootstrap 4 instead of Bootstrap 3 to go through and rip through your layout.cs HTML and so forth.
Yeah, stuff that's tedious like that should not be tedious.
No, it shouldn't. And I don't want people to be doing my video training course, which is supposed to be fun and interesting and entertaining, and have me go, right, so delete all these script references from your layout file and then replace them with these ones here, which you can't even copy and paste because this is a video. And, you know, it's just hideous. So just say, download this global tool and then just run it in your project directory.
There is a list of global tools at Nate McMaster's GitHub. Nate McMaster works on global tools, and he's building quite a list of several dozen extremely useful tools.
Yeah, I've got a couple on there. So Unpackage is on there.
Mm-hmm.
It's questionable whether Unpackage is going to continue because the library manager Microsoft tool is providing a lot of the same functionality now. But I always like it. A lot of people get upset when Microsoft come along and do a version of something that they were doing. And I can understand that for bigger things where, you know, maybe you're building a business around it and it's an important part of that. But for me personally, with a lot of these things that I do to scratch my itch, if Microsoft then come along and go, hey, we've done the same thing, I'll go, cool, thank you, and start using that.
Now you don't have to worry about yours.
Exactly. I've got many, many things that I want to be working on. So anyone doing other stuff, other versions of it is great. But the other one I've got, and this is the nice thing the thing I think is really nice about this, I use JetBrains Rider, and I install it through the JetBrains toolbox, and I have a nightly build that updates itself every single day, and I want to be able to start it from the command line. I want to be able to say rider thingy.sln. Sure. And on Linux and Mac, for some reason, there's a tools option in the menu to say create command line, and you just click that, and then you can run rider from the command line. It doesn't work on Windows. It's not there. And so I just wrote this very, very quick console application. Yeah. And all it does is it looks in your toolbox folder and it finds the most recent version of Rider and it runs it with the SLN file.
So to put it differently, they have a bug on adding themselves to the path on Windows and you got tired of waiting and made a tool for it.
Yes.
That's awesome.
And it was really quick. And it's, you know, it's only had like a few dozen downloads, I think. I don't care. It's for me. And I made it because I wanted it. And I published it onto NuGet. And so anytime I get a new machine or want to do something on a new machine, then I can just say .NET tool IG Rider. And it brings it down and puts it on the machine for me.
Well, and that's a good reminder to us who are listening that we can write these tools as well. For people who are excited about open source, certainly this is a way to get involved, but there's no requirement for someone to go and make these things public. They could be on your private NuGet and they could be used at your company.
Absolutely. And I know a lot of companies are doing that where they've got sort of paid hosted MyGet feeds, or they're running something like Artifactory internally, and they're using that to publish and share tools around the place as well.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that I would really want to say to people who are thinking about doing this is go and look on my Rendell Labs GitHub organization and find the Rider thing in there. It's tiny. It's like, I think it's 50 lines of code, and most of those are navigating directories and checking that things are in where they're supposed to be.
To be fair, I was looking at the code and it could have been 20. It's just that you were being extremely, you know, clean about it. You looked in appropriate folders. You even supported three different operating systems just to be sure. You know,
yeah.
It's a pretty great example of a good starting place for a simple tool.
Yes. And I think the first version probably was about 20 lines because in that GitHub repository, you can see issues from people going, I put in an error message that said something can't be done if this makes you sad, and then had a link to my issues page. And so I got lots of people opening issues going, this makes me sad. Mm. But yeah, the point is, it's so easy to do this. So you literally, beyond the sort of having to put package ID and description and license acceptance and everything else, you need to add two properties to your csproj file. There's a packers tool true, which you have to put in, and then a tool command name attribute, which is what people will type to invoke it. So it's really absolutely minimum effort. And it doesn't have to be this big, long, complicated thing like .NET itself or like Git or something where it supports a dozen subcommands and each of those has got another dozen subcommands. It can just be something that does one thing, and you thought, I'm so fed up with typing these three commands every time I do something. Just wrap it up and put it in as a .NET tool. And then, you know, if it gets traction and people like using it, then go back and make --help work, because that's always nice.
But in the short term, you do one thing and you do it well.
Absolutely, which I believe was the Unix philosophy.
It is, isn't it? Well, fantastic. I'm excited that people will hopefully start to learn about and create their own .NET global tools, and hopefully they'll check yours out. And we can go to rendellabs.com. I'll put a link in the show notes, and people can learn about your courseware that's coming up soon.
Yes, thank you. That'd be great.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.